My name is Tad Leithead. I'm the chairman of the Atlanta Regional Commission. And here at the ARC, we are extremely pleased to join the Enterprise Community Partners and Peace by Peace in hosting this very important conversation today. And I think the word conversation is key to our intent for the day. You will hear from important speakers or relevant speakers, investors in our community, stakeholders in our community, and many others, and they will inform the process and they will speak to you. But what we're hoping for today is a conversation with those that are present about how we tackle the very important residential and housing issues that we're facing in our region today. ARC has been very delighted to participate on the Peace by Peace Leadership Committee since it was formed in late 2010. And as the planning organization for the entire region, we strongly believe that collaboration across public and private sectors is really the key to success in our region. And if you look at the makeup of the ARC, we have 23 elected members and 15 private citizens who serve on our board. And so public-private cooperation, collaboration, and again, conversation is very much the benchmark of the operations of the Atlanta Regional Commission and of what we're trying to accomplish today. I don't think it's going to come as any great surprise to any of you here in the room today that foreclosure has devastated our neighborhoods and home ownership in our region over the last several years. Georgia and the Atlanta region have been as hard hit by foreclosure as any place in the country, and it has devastated families. It has literally caused families to lose their homes. Residential development as an industry has ground to a halt, and many have suffered as a result of this. Now, things are improving in our region, as you all know, but things are improving very slowly, and we are by no means out of the woods. There are areas in Atlanta where home values are increasing, but some of the hardest hit areas are still suffering badly. Tens of thousands of people who own homes are still underwater on their mortgages and, again, facing foreclosure. And vacancies remain very high. In the last 18 months, things have changed. Investors have purchased over 40,000 homes in this market over the last 18 months. At one time, investors were buying one out of 10 homes in our market. Recently, it's been in the neighborhood of one out of four. So there are institutional and large investors that are coming into our community and making investments, which indicate a confidence that things are beginning to recover in Atlanta. Vacant homes have been rehabbed and occupied, many on a rental basis. And although rental is a great solution, we need in our community to maintain a balance between rental properties and owned properties simply for the health of the economic health of our residential industry. As a region, it's important for us to understand these trends. How can we harness the benefits of private capital, which is now beginning to flow back into our market and into our neighborhoods, which is a trend that we think will continue, but at the same time, make sure that code enforcement is in place, that the investors are maintaining and providing service to the rental community in a way that's in keeping with the codes that we have in our region, and that proper enforcement is in place. We need to make sure that the people who do rent these properties are served well and that their rental experience is a positive one, and one which hopefully may transition at some point to home ownership. But it's critical that we work on this together. And again, I'm going to say that today is about collaboration. Today is about a conversation as to how we take these incredibly difficult challenges that we have faced, a slowly improving environment, and make sure that we manage that trend in a way that is best for our homeowners, best for those who rent properties, and ultimately best for those citizens who are in our region. Today, you'll hear from investors, code enforcement officials, not-for-profits, and community stakeholders, and all of them will give presentations to you about what are potentially our next steps. But again, your feedback for this to be a successful day is absolutely necessary. It's always my role as chairman to give the welcoming remarks. However, the work, the real work, is done by others. So it's my pleasure at this point to bring to the podium Dan Reuter. Dan is with the Atlanta Regional Commission. He serves as our manager of community development and has been a huge asset to this region in terms of some of the issues that I just addressed. So Dan and his team have been a very integral part of this Piece by Piece initiative. Please welcome Dan to the podium. Dan.
Good morning, everyone. Before I get started, I do want to recognize we do have Chairman Richard Oden from Rockdale County here today, and also on our Atlanta Regional Commission board, Kerry Armstrong in the back there. He's trying to remain quietly in the back, but he's here. Any other elected officials that are here this morning? Mayor. I just spoke to her just a few minutes ago. Mayor, if you'd stand up and say hello from Lithonia. Thank you. And we had a long conversation. I'd also like to just recognize all of the speakers that we're going to have today and just thank you. And then in particular, George Bergen and Susan Adams of Atlanta Neighborhood Development Partnership and Marissa Ghani of ARC that have helped so much to put this event on today. I'm going to be very brief and just introduce our next speakers. I've heard Dan Immergluck speak already once this week, and I can't tell you how fortunate we are to have Dan here in Metro Atlanta, really someone that understands so much about the data, so much about our national policy in housing. He's just, a wonderful professor. I've never sat in his classes. I taught a few years at Georgia Tech as an adjunct, and I know how difficult that is. So I'm sure you're a wonderful professor. And he's in the School of City and Regional Planning at Georgia Tech, and he teaches and conducts research on issues of housing, community development, real estate finance, urban development, and related topics. He's the author of 3 books, more than 40 scholarly articles, numerous chapters and encyclopedia entries, and scores of applied research and policy reports. Dan has worked with federal, state, and local governments, foundations, and nonprofits on a wide variety of projects. He has testified several times before Congress, as well as before the Federal Reserve Board and a variety of state and local legislative bodies. He's has served as a senior fellow with the Center for Community Progress and is a visiting scholar for the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. And that's where I've known during this last 4 or 5 years. We've received so much assistance from Dan, really thinking about the issues that are have led to our recession. He is on the board of the Urban Affairs Association and serves on the Academic Research Council of the Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And he has a PhD from the University of Illinois in Chicago and a Master's of Public Policy from the University of Michigan. And Dan, I'm going to go ahead and ask you to come on up to the stage and have a seat, and I will then introduce our next speaker, who is Mike Minitelli. Mike is the managing partner and co-founder of the McAllen Group, a holding company for a portfolio of real estate and construction-related companies. I will have to tell you that Mike is a Georgia Tech grad. I taught at Georgia Tech a couple years. I'm actually a UGA grad, Georgia State grad. Have a daughter at Georgia. I'm very conflicted. But the McAllen Group was founded in 2002. Please come on up, Mike. Thank you. Was founded in 2002 as a specialty construction company and has since grown into 6 interrelated operating companies with over 60 employees. The McAllen Companies specialize in commercial general contracting, special trade subcontracting, material distribution, custom home building, real estate brokerage, program management, and municipal consulting. Wow, I need to come see you after I retire. The McAllen Group has been named Contractor of the Year by the National Association of the Remodeling Industry and has been ranked by the Atlanta Business Chronicle as the number one renovation company in Atlanta, and has purchased and revitalized over 70 homes as an asset manager for both the City of Atlanta and Gwinnett County Neighborhood Stabilization Programs. So please help me in welcoming both of our speakers. Again, we are super fortunate to have so many wonderful speakers here today, and I know we're going to learn so much about this issue. And Dan, would you like to stay there or come up to the podium?
I'll come up.
Okay.
Thanks, Dan. I want to thank ARC, ANDP, and Enterprise, particularly Susan Adams, George Bergen, Odetta McLeish-White, and a Georgia Tech City Planning grad, Marissa Ghani, most importantly, perhaps. Mike was just telling me he's a building construction grad, which is in the same college as city planning, so it's almost as good as city planning. I'm going to talk about research I've done. Most of this, the Atlanta work, is work that was done 6 to 8 months ago. A lot of the work was actually being done in 2000, most of it was being done in 2012. And it was a mixed, what we call a mixed methods project, between doing both quantitative analysis and qualitative interviewing. But I'm also going to try to speed through that a bit. Some people have seen a good amount of it, the Atlanta stuff. So I have time to talk about what I'll call the cross-site report, because this was part of a four-city study with Atlanta being one of four cities, with Las Vegas, Cleveland, and Boston. And those studies are, well, I got done first, let me put it that way. Those studies are mostly done. Cleveland's lagging a bit. But I've seen the draft kind of cross-site report, so I'll be trying to spend some time on that. I do want to acknowledge the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard, who managed the whole project, and the What Works Collaborative, which is a collaborative of national foundations that funded the work. Pointing, but it's not.
There we go.
There it goes. I think that was you. There you go. Thank you. So you're Georgia Tech grad. So this is the part of the quantitative work. Oops, I went back. This is part of the quantitative work of just identifying what I call likely REO investors and mapping the neighborhoods with the highest density, meaning per single family unit, of likely REO investors. This is as of the end of 2011. I did this in 2012. I think things may have changed some, and certainly the institutional investors moved in after this data. But I'm going to suggest, and I think Mike's data suggests, that probably in the city, in the dark areas, things haven't changed a whole lot in terms of who the investors are, meaning the bigger investors, I think, are not as active in these neighborhoods. And basically, for folks who aren't familiar with Atlanta, people who are will know this, that I broke the dark neighborhoods census tracts are what I call high investor and very high investor. Those are the right two columns, neighborhoods. And then the lightest color are low investor neighborhoods. And what you see here is that the high investor neighborhoods are predominantly African American, predominantly high poverty, and very high vacancy rates, over 20-30% vacancy rates, where the numbers on the kind of low intensity, low investor tracks are much lower. So these are basically low poverty, predominantly white, and low vacancy tracks. What you also see here is that, what you also see is that much higher percentage of properties to likely investors in the high investor tracks, which you would expect. But then we looked at flipping and defined flipping, you can define it lots of different ways, as reselling a property within 12 months. And basically, the flipping numbers were lower than I think some people expected, but they were higher. They were basically higher in. I'm sorry, I'm jumping down here. They were basically higher in low investor tracks, and I would argue that that was primarily because at this point in time, 2010, 2011, the properties in high investor tracks were hard to sell. So people may have intended to flip the properties, but probably were having a hard time. The other thing is, of the sales to investors in the high investor tracks, the high poverty tracks, they were generally to somewhat larger investors, but still the bulk of investors across the board were very small investors, all under 100 properties for the whole county in a year, and in a two-year period, I'm sorry, and generally much smaller than that. And then this last number basically says, of properties flipped, those reflip to other investors. That number was much higher in the high investor, high poverty tracks than it was in the low poverty tracks, and that's as I expected. The flips in the low poverty tracks were generally to homeowners. This chart just lists the top investors in the period we focused on was 2008 to 2000 through 2011, and I wanted to see if there were shifts over time, and we basically found that there were, a lot of investors who seemed to exit the market. The other thing to notice on the 2010-2011 table, of the top five investors, you might not know this, but of the top five investors, four of them were related to the NSP program. So NSP definitely had an impact, but it also had an impact after the big rush of investors in 2008-2009 had moved into the market. The other thing to notice is the yellow at the bottom. Even with these somewhat bigger investors buying 70, 80, 100 properties in a couple years, the top 10 investors only accounted for about 10 to 12% of the investor purchases across this period. So highly atomized, highly distributed market. The qualitative work that I did really focused on neighborhoods with the most investors. And those are predominantly on the south and southwest side of the city. And I use three neighborhoods or census tracts as kind of references to talk about, but I interviewed investors who are active generally on the south and southwest side, but particularly wanted some neighbors to talk about that were at different levels of vacancy, particularly. And so I talked about Westview neighborhood, the Pittsburgh neighborhood as the most kind of distressed, and Venetian Hills as kind of the least distressed. In the interviews, and this is very consistent across the four sites, I basically reinforced a typology of investor strategies that Alan Malik has talked about. Alan Malik's a national researcher on housing issues and vacant property issues. The flipper who, is what it sounds like. The flipper tries to buy in either poor, different types of properties and sells them in a short period of time. That's as opposed to the rehabber who puts a lot of money into a project and then essentially flips the building. Those are both essentially the old classic kind of buy to sell investors. And then the buy to rent investors, which is really what's dominated, of course, in the last few years. Alan created a typology of the milker who buys in poor condition and basically rents in poor condition and puts as little money into the property as possible, hoping to basically make 18-20% annual returns because of the very little small amount of money they put in, and then maybe sell the property for a loss later on, but because they've gotten 20% returns for 5 or 7 years, they're okay. Maybe they keep it for a long period of time, and then maybe they walk away from it when things don't work out. And then the short-term and longer-term holders, I think this is where the large investors are going to fall, generally the institutional investors. And this is really a difference between whether you think you can sell in 3 to 5 years with most of your gain being made on the sale price versus holding for a longer period, making more gain on operating, maybe selling to another investor who continues to rent the property out. I think Mike's going to talk more about investor strategies. Basically, the lessons from Atlanta were that acquisition factors, again, this was focused on the central city low-income distressed neighborhoods, was that crime, vacancy, and homeownership rates were the dominant drivers of where investors wanted to buy properties. Really, folks didn't bring up schools as much as I think you might hear from the institutional investors later. These were folks who were all buying in the same school district, essentially. All of the investors I talked to were relying on all cash financing. Of course, the price points on these properties is typically $10,000 to $25,000, maybe $30,000, $35,000 at the upper end. So mortgage financing is not so important usually. A lot of discussion of the importance of housing choice vouchers, Section 8 vouchers, and how advantageous that was to have a Section 8 client versus a market client. Keep in mind, these are mostly lower income renters, and the stability of the renter stream with a housing choice voucher is probably much better than with a tenant who's subject to the vagaries of the economy. Investors, surprisingly to me, none of them complained about housing code enforcement except for other properties that they didn't own. So they complained about the property next door to them dragging down the value of their property, but they didn't complain about the housing code enforcement kind of coming after them. Now, this was 2012. Maybe things have improved, because I kind of wanted to hear that they were being, you know, to some degree, pressured to improve properties, and I generally didn't hear that. Now, I may have been only talking to better investors. Actually, I know that that's not quite true. But I may have been disproportionately talking to better investors, because as you would expect, the kind of milkers, as Alan would call, would be less likely to respond to my request to interview, although I think I did talk to at least one of them. And I got an email later saying, "Are you calling me a milker?" And I didn't. In the report, I did not. But they recognized themselves. So let's put it that way. Finally, I was doing the interviews in 2012 when the large institutional investors were just moving into Atlanta. So I asked other investors, because the investors I talked to generally were not large or institutional. They were seeing the large institutional investors moving in, competing with them, but saying they were predominantly not buying in these neighborhoods. They were predominantly buying in suburban neighborhoods with higher values and less distress. Now, I wanted to really get to the cross-site study some, since this is newer information. And we picked very different cities on purpose. And Boston particularly was kind of a control city because it didn't have the foreclosure problem that these other cities had. It had a foreclosure problem, but not at the scale. And it has, even during the crisis, a tight rental market. So really quite different city and a higher value market. So the top row is important because it shows you the kind of typical all-in cost for an investor in a distressed neighborhood, not in a suburban neighborhood, not in a middle-income neighborhood. But even in a distressed neighborhood in Boston, you're talking $150,000, $200,000 all-in costs at least, compared to Cleveland, which is typically well under $50,000. The investor characteristics, at least at this time, generally small investors in all cities, much more non-local investors in Las Vegas, as you might expect, a lot of international investors. Boston, highly local investors, but somewhat more concentrated. I mean, still small, but not as small as the other cities. So there were a handful to 10 investors in Boston that accounted for about 40% of the rental market in Boston, which is, these other cities have nothing like that. Now, Las Vegas may now, because the institutional investors have moved in. but at the time they did not. Another important finding was in Cleveland, maybe because values are so low and the market is so weak, in distressed neighborhoods, there was little buy-to-rent activity. It was mostly still flipping to other people and very little of that, a lot of just stagnation. There had been a lot of flipping, but now there were no more buyers willing to buy properties for $15,000 or $20,000, and there was less rehab, very little rehab going on, a lot of just dead properties sitting around. In terms of rehab activity, one big factor, I think, is both in Boston and driving the market in Boston and Atlanta, less so in Las Vegas for whatever reason, was housing choice vouchers. In both these markets, the housing authority has standards and would require rehab up to a certain standard. So you had to put in a decent amount of money to meet the standards of the Atlanta Housing Authority. The lower end milkers avoided Section 8 because they would not meet those standards. So housing choice vouchers both provide the subsidy necessary to invest in the property to make it work and the kind of quality control. And I know lots of people complain about housing choice vouchers, but in this market, it seemed like housing choice vouchers were actually the higher end units as opposed to the lower end units within these distressed markets. Finally, financing, as I said, mostly cash. The one place where this was more mixed was Boston. You're talking price points, again, of $150,000. So a lot of investors used hard money lenders to acquire properties. They also used cash, especially the bigger ones. And then once they get the properties and rehab them, they would refinance them with community banks. So this was much to basically replenish their coffers to acquire more properties. What did I do? Can I hit that bottom right there? No? There. Good. So, lessons for policy and practice, not just out of Atlanta, but out of the cross-site report so far, and I haven't checked with my co-authors from the cross-site cities, so these are my lessons. I think most of them would agree with them, and I did run these by them, and nobody shrieked, so I think they're okay. One is that investor behavior is very fluid, very fast-moving, and boy, if any city knows that, it's Atlanta. I mean, in 2008, 2009, a flood of investors, small investors, bought a ton of properties dumped by lenders. Now we're seeing the large investors move into predominantly the suburban markets and have moved in very aggressively. And part of the lesson there, it was very hard to design a kind of clunky NSP program to work in that kind of fast-moving market, I'm afraid. I'm not saying NSP was a bad idea, but I think the next time we got to think about a much faster-moving program. A second finding is that the NSP-type gut rehab, very high-end, especially for these markets, low-end markets, really deterred investor activity, meaning from participating in that program. One respondent said, they wanted me to do $40,000 of work for $80,000, meaning even if they could make it work on that property, they didn't want to have their contractors and other folks charging that kind of money because it wasn't a sustainable model for them. They were used to doing $30,000 or $40,000 of rehab. They weren't going to change that model for a temporary program. But generally, the other cities report the same thing, really with the exception of Boston, which makes sense. The Boston price points are so high that rehab at that higher price point kind of works and makes sense and is more typical of the market, not so far away. A third point is that housing and vacant property code enforcement really provide a critical context for local investor behavior. All the cities talked about how important it was. The investors themselves talked about how important it was to have good housing code enforcement to deter the bad guys, basically, from undercutting the good guys. Next, I really think this issue about housing choice vouchers is so important. People say, well, housing choice vouchers are only 25% at most of the low-income renter market. They're probably less than that. But in these markets, sometimes they're, in some neighborhoods, they can be 50%. So they're drivers of the rental market in distressed neighborhoods sometimes. And we're seeing pressure on housing choice vouchers from the sequester and from, obviously, things going on right now that, you know, we may, the most critical source of subsidy for this kind of rental housing in these kinds of neighborhoods may be kind of at threat in the long term. So you need to think about alternative subsidy, and that might be, and particularly local and state, and that might take the form of tax subsidy, that might take the form of financing subsidy. The caveat to that, from my point of view, is it's got to be quality controlled, meaning it's got to have annual inspections like housing choice vouchers do. It's got to meet standards. You don't want to subsidize slumlords, obviously. Finally, we need, as I think Mike's, one of Mike's slides going to show, is that generally these neighborhoods have not been where the large institutional investors have moved into. And I think we need more partnerships to get large institutional investors to move into these neighborhoods in responsible ways. Because I don't want a two-tiered system where the large institutional investors invest in middle-income suburban markets and Maz and Paz only invest in Central City. I think for all kinds of reasons that, I'm not saying large institutional investors are always good, small investors are important, but I think we need the same kind of standards, the same kind of expectations coming into the distressed neighborhoods as we have going into the suburban neighborhoods. I'll end it there.
And we are going to hold questions until after Mike's presentation.
Good morning. I'm Mike Minutelli with the McAllen Group, and pleasure to be here this morning. I've presented this one time before for ANDP, for John and Susan, and Dan was there as well. And our presentation was put together as part of a mini-TAP, which is a technical assistance panel, which is part of the ULI. And along with four other ULI members, we were asked to work with ANDP on researching the impact of the institutional investors on the Atlanta market. And when we were assigned this about 12 months ago, there was not as much headline or talking about it. It was just really starting to heat up from the impact that we were seeing in Atlanta, but it was really exciting as we went through the process. There was more and more media coverage about it, and as speed picked up in institutional investing in Atlanta, our research became a lot more relevant. So to take you through what we did with this process, we really broke our research down into seven areas. One we looked at first, and our research is more at a 30,000 foot level based on what Dan did. He really drilled down, and a disclaimer for this too is Dan's research was conducted at Georgia Tech and funded by Harvard. Ours was pro bono work and fueled by beer and pizza on the weekend, so it's a little bit different. But I'll take you through what we did and the information that we came up with, because I think we really dug into some relevant facts. So once we looked at the benefit analysis, we looked at the impact on Metro Atlanta sales, and some of these numbers are a little bit dated because we completed this the end of April, and I've updated some of the numbers to be more relevant to today. And then what ANDP really wanted to do, where Dan drilled down in the urban areas, they wanted to look at the suburban market, and it was too big of a project to tackle the entire suburban market. So we focused on Lawrenceville, the hardest hit zip code from a foreclosure standpoint of any zip code in the United States. And then we profiled the five large institutional investors that we interviewed and tried to gather as much information from as possible. And you're going to hear from a number of those companies today, but we talked to Waypoint, Sylvan Road, Colony, Silver Bay, and Invitation Homes, or Blackstone. And we've got different profiles for those. And then we analyzed the current inventory and then just kind of summarized it all and left some open questions that I think our panelists are going to address later on today. So these are some of the headlines that I was talking about. If you look at the dates on here, about a year ago, October 17th, Phoenix picked clean, private equity descends on Atlanta. And I think that's why we're all here today talking about this. And you can see the dates as we go through the different chronology of all these articles where, you know, the latest one, Bloomberg, and on April 25th, Blackstone buys Atlanta Homes and largest rental trade, So, as I said, the headlines started to change and become more relevant. So we went and talked to all these institutional investors and tried to gather as much information as we could. And we broke it down to say, what are the arguments for this investment? What good are they doing? And why is this a positive, why is this going to have a positive impact on our community? And again, we're going to hear some of these arguments later, but the institutional ownership offers much greater stability than a mom-and-pop investor. They have much more backing, and they have different strict underwriting criteria that leads to more qualified renters. So maintenance standards were also an issue that came up over and over again, as far as each one of these companies has set standards of how they're going to maintain their homes, which you may not see from a smaller investor. And another argument that we heard over and over again is the length of stay for these renters in these houses, and that the average renter in a single-family home will stay about 3 years, which is half of that from a multifamily rental situation. And all of the companies, I mean, this is an argument kind of for them, but they all said that the public has an antiquated view of the single-family rental market. It hasn't been done before, but so we're entering a new phase of this type of product, and I think we all are a little unsure of how it's going to go, so we tend to focus on the bad and not on the good. And the next point I had on here, and this is something that David Zanatti, who's going to speak in a little bit, really focused on too, is just from an investment standpoint, are we changing the way that we think about, after the crisis that we've gone through from a foreclosure standpoint, how we invest our money? Is the American dream different now? Should 100% of your net worth be tied up into one single asset that's illiquid and that you can't move? And I thought that was a really good point that David made. And will we see a transition in the next generation of people who have seen their parents go through foreclosures or not be able to relocate and really take a different view on how they purchase their homes or how they choose to spend their money from mortgage versus rental? And another key point too was just the flexibility in being able to move from house to house. If people weren't tied down from a foreclosure standpoint, could they travel to the jobs more easily? Would unemployment be driven down from that standpoint? And the numbers are skewed all over the place. It's hard to really get a read because of what's public and what's not and the way that the homes are purchased. But in reality, what we're talking about, at least today, has been a real fraction of the total number of homes. Our numbers through 2012, we had around 100,000 single-family homes were purchased by the large institutional investors. We think that number is about double now. But again, it's still a fraction of the 13 million homes for rent in the U.S. And in Atlanta alone, that number, at the end of 2012, we had pegged at about 20,000 homes, and since then has doubled to about 40,000 homes. So again, when you look at it on a total homes in city of Atlanta, these numbers may not be as great as we think, but it's obviously having an impact. So I think these are all the questions that we want our panelists to answer later, or these are the arguments against institutional investing. And I think the biggest one is the bubble factor. And are we creating a bubble with the buying that's happened and driving prices up? And I'll have a slide that speaks to that in a second, as well as just irresponsible investing. And we've read all these articles where there's been thousands of homes purchased that they may have not even seen the home. And what impact is that going to have as these houses cycle through the market? And just how are these models set up? Are they pure speculation? I mean, we've heard each one of the different models, but 5 years from now, what is this really going to look like? And, you know, one of our concerns, too, from a purchasing standpoint, is if some of these homes were a bad investment, do they sit vacant? These larger firms have the funds to let the homes just sit there. And then what does that do to the neighborhood if they can't dispose of the asset, and then we have just a blight in that neighborhood of homes that are unoccupied? So, and then the next area we focused on was the fabric of the community. Are the renters really going to invest in their community? Are they going to become part of the HOA? Are they going to participate in a way that's meaningful like a single-family homeowner would? So these were all the questions that I think we're going to hear from later, and these were kind of the arguments that we came up with against it. Are we creating the next bubble? And these are numbers that we had from Smart Numbers, and if you just look at, these are all year-over-year numbers, and really we've seen the institutional investors really started to hit the Atlanta market somewhere between 18 to 24 months. And so year over year from February, home prices have increased 29%, sales of closings have increased 60%, and then there's been a 67% increase in the number of building permits. Well, this is all positive news if it's sustainable and if it's not creating a bubble that we're going to see a fallback from. The next three bullets on here are all more recent information that we receive from Smart Numbers, where 52% of all Metro Atlanta resales, not new homes, just resales, in 2012 were purchased by investors. So what happens when the investors stop buying these homes? What happens in the market then? And of those homes, of the 25% of all resales in 2012, of all the resales in 2012, 25% of them were purchased at $50,000 or less. So that was a big number when we saw that too, that we thought was interesting. But since then, we've seen a dramatic rise as the lower end of the foreclosure inventory has been taken off the market. We've seen a dramatic increase in the average single family sales price. And this is resales, not new homes. And that price is up to almost $223,000, which is only $7,000 off the all-time high in Atlanta. So again, positive news if we're not creating a bubble of what happens when these buyers go away. The one zip code that we focused in on, which I touched on earlier, was Lawrenceville, the hardest hit zip code. And what we did with this research is Smart Numbers gave us their whole database for a year of closings in this zip code. And we called out and threw out 90% of them because they were foreclosures that were acquired by a bank. So of that left about 138, and we were just looking at corporations that had purchased homes. So there were 138 corporations that had purchased homes in the zip code. And we thought we were going to see all the big names of the people we were talking to. Well, in reality, we saw none of them. Part of it was because it was too early in the cycle for the larger investors to be buying in this zip code based on their strategies. And so what we saw, or in the second part of it, some of these could have been other buyers that were buying for larger investors. And it was very hard to dig deep enough to get to who the buyers really were. So you can see the breakdown here of how many companies and the number of homes that they bought. Where the majority of these were buying just one home, and then a much smaller percentage bought 10 or more houses. So here's a breakdown of who those companies were. And I don't know if this slide is that meaningful, but it gives you an idea of the price point and the number of homes where these buyers were buying in this zip code. And it ranged all the way from an average of $40,000 up to an average of just below $120,000. And as I said on the bottom are the names of all the larger investors that we could find, but again, we could find very little information on who these buyers were and had some of the same problems that Dan had in his research on trying to get to that information. So when we talked to all five companies, they were very tight-lipped on wanting to share information about their buying strategy, their secret formula of how they're going about this. But when it came down to it, they're all very similar with very small nuances. And so we kind of grouped them all together to, you know, protect the information that we were given. And this is kind of an amalgamation of the four privately held companies we had at Silver Bay second, just because their information was public and a little bit more easy to attain. So I think I'd break this down, and the panelists can speak to this a little bit more later, into two categories where we found that Waypoint and Sylvan Road's approach was much more similar, and then Colony and Invitation were more similar to each other as well, where Waypoint and Sylvan Road seemed to have a very kind of rifle approach to specific areas, mostly driven by schools or price points or demographics that met their scoring sheet or criteria, where Colony and Invitation seemed to be more driven by the depressed value of the home or the realization of the asset on the future buyer, how inexpensive they could get the house. But you could see here that the average rent ranges somewhere between $1,000 and $1,400 a month for all these companies, and their average purchase was somewhere between the 70 to 90 range, with rehab costs somewhere between $20,000 and $40,000. And again, this information is about 6 months old, so when we hear from our panelists later, it may have changed slightly since then. So Silver Bay was kind of in between all of those, where if we put the rifle and the shotgun approach, Silver Bay was somewhere in the middle. And these are all the stats that we had on Silver Bay, which again, similar in a lot of ways, and I think everyone has their own nuances in how they're buying their homes and the process they go about it. But everything was kind of in the middle here from average price point to average rehab, et cetera. So what we really wanted to do after we got to this point was understand where everyone was buying. And this was a little bit of a challenging process to go through, but we went on every one of the websites of the five companies that we interviewed and took all their existing rental inventory as of April 30th. And we analyzed the supply of what they had. So there were 406 housing units for rent between these five firms on that date. And then you can see the breakdown of Blackstone with the majority of those at 45%, and then the rest split up kind of semi-evenly between the rest. And then you can see the bottom graph shows you price point wise of where those homes were renting, what price point they were at. And this is one of my favorite slides where we got down to, this shows you where all those homes are. So when we talked to each one of these individual investors and they said, well, we're buying in Gwinnett or Cobb because of the school system, we could really see that where, you know, you can see Waypoint is somewhat concentrated in the areas where they're buying, where Blackstone's a little bit more spread out all over. And, you know, Waypoint, when we interviewed them, said we're not really buying south of 20 now. Now they may be buying south of 20 there, but this map reflected that. And you could see the different pockets. And to Dan's point, I don't know if I can point on this. I'm not going to mess it up. You can see the pocket just south of 20 where there is no investing. And that's a neighborhood that Dan looked at, the Pittsburgh area, where the institutional investors have been, it hasn't met their underwriting criteria for purchasing homes there. And so you can see in this map, there's all pockets of areas throughout the city where institutional investors at that time had no rental availability. So, and then we overlay that as well with price point. And you can look from a price point standpoint, a pricing standpoint of where those houses are, with, you know, the majority of those houses being in the $800 to $1,050 range from a rental standpoint. And then you can even see some houses up there that are over $1,600, which is not typically what we think of a single family rental, but you can kind of get a feel for that and where those are throughout Metro Atlanta. So, in summary, what does this really mean to us, and what did we glean from all this information? Well, as we just saw from that map, not every zip code is benefiting from this. Even though it's raised the sales price of Atlanta, there's certain areas where the investors are either scared to go or it doesn't meet their model, and so they're not benefiting. And in those zip codes, there's room for smaller investors still, which just from an anecdotal standpoint, as a McAllen Group, we purchased NSP homes for about 3 years, and as soon as the institutional investors started buying houses, the inventory that met the criteria of the program was really not there. And I think smaller investors have seen that in a lot of these areas too, which I think is a positive thing. I mean, it's a government program that was supposed to fill a gap, and now the market has corrected itself with institutional investors that are now taking the place of that. But what we want to make sure is that it's done responsibly and that it's done in a way that's going to benefit all of these neighborhoods. And then the second part is the amount of rental stock that's coming onto the market. We don't know what the impact's going to be when you compound that with multifamily inventory along with single family inventory. And is that going to depress rental prices? Is that going to change the models of how these acquisitions were underwritten in a way that is going to negatively impact the investment? So the other, what we'll hear too is that these investors are long-term holders, and that's what they all say, but we want to see if that really plays out. I mean, there's no way to tell if that will be the case. And I think once we get to this will be a historic look back and see what the real impact is. So it's hard to really predict at this point what the real impact will be. So our last slide, these are kind of the open questions that we came up, which are probably a good lead into what we're going to talk about throughout the rest of the morning. And I think a big question is, can these institutional investors effectively manage these properties that are spread out over a 60-mile radius of where they're purchasing? And they'll say yes, and they have a program of how they're going to do it, but it's untested, and it's unknown of whether it's going to be successful. If the market improves to such a point, are they going to flip the houses, and are they going to be sold in a way that they're no longer being responsibly cared for, and it's different from the model that they've seen? I think there's been three of these REITs that have gone public, and all of their stock prices have dropped since their IPO. I think Waypoint had kind of we're going to have an IPO, as Colony did, and then not. So it's been a lot of back and forth, and how is this really going to play out from the standpoint of where the investment will go in the long term. So, and then what other large-scale investors will enter the Atlanta market? Is this it? Is this what we're going to see? Or are there going to be more people coming to Atlanta? Is this going to be the buying for the future? So, again, it was an interesting process to go through, and we enjoyed kind of analyzing this. It's as we said, it was pro bono work from the standpoint of working with ANDP, but just jumping into this and the amount of attention that it's getting now, and after hearing Dan speak a couple times, it was really exciting. I think what we're going to hear the rest of the day is going to be a follow-up to what we've presented here today. So thank you very much.
We are on a super tight schedule today, and so we are really want to get to our other speakers and have a lot of great information presented. We have time for maybe one or two questions. Does anybody have a burning question? Way in the back, sir. Yeah, if you could use the microphone right up here.
My question goes to the theory of land trust. And from your data, is it possible to consider community land trust as an investment model, either at the mom and pop level or at the institutional level?
And honestly, I'm not sure if either one of you are prepared to answer that. It's kind of a complicated question.
It's a big question. I think the answer is yes, especially in the more distressed, lower income neighborhoods, particularly because price points are still very low. So if somebody has the ability to, you know, assemble the right parcels, get the capital to assemble those and maintain those, I think the answer is yes.
Could that be an end game for some of these big investment companies? I mean, they've already, once they make a lot of money, they could just give the homes back to us.
Yeah. There actually is a corporate model of land trusts. The city of Irvine, California, and the University of California, Irvine, is basically mostly a community land trust that's corporately developed. But that's, you know, a small contiguous area with the university sponsorship.
We have another question.
Quick question. Jornell Thomas, and I live in the historic Western Heights Bankhead neighborhood, which has not been identified. But I have two quick questions. One, what is NSP? Number two, so when you use acronyms and you're talking to us who are not investors, please identify what it is that you're talking about so that we can understand you better. Number two, what was the other question? I probably went out of the window, but that's one of the ones that I want to ask you. I remember now. Where can we get copies of your studies that you're presenting here so that we can digest it better?
All of the information will be on the Atlanta Regional Housing website, .com. Right. So there's two different options, AtlantaRegionalHousing.org or PieceByPiece.org. We'll have all the presentations. You want to just say NSP? So Neighborhood Stabilization Program is a program that was, I think, first under the Bush administration. Yeah, okay. And then continued under the Stimulus Act and has been very influential in our region. Last question, sir.
It has to be understood, as a Vine City resident, we went from the census of 2000 to 2010 and lost 16,000 persons. So what we're looking at is 2,074 blighted properties, 2,074 in a 600-acre radius. What we're looking at is a land trust program that the gentleman just spoke about, and you mentioned corporate land trust, but we're on the ground. Grassroots, ground level, knocking on the door to get the participants who are left in those two neighborhoods, and you're talking about a full systemic displacement. Because you mentioned code violations, well, the one violation that everybody knows about in the city of Atlanta is the violation of a 6-month period to have a boarded up house or a burnt out house. So if in fact our neighbor who just moved in can only afford a $7,000 buy of a property, but yet on one block there's 17 properties that are closed down, how do we as a neighborhood on the ground get people to understand, let's get the absentee owners, now this is a question, how do we do this? Let's get the absentee owners in here or kick them out.
Again, another tough question. And I know we actually probably have some people in the audience that that might even be able to address that, because I know there's a lot of work going on in the city of Atlanta around this issue, but that's a tough neighborhood for sure. Yes, that's who I was looking for. Okay. You'd introduce. Okay. So
can I try
take
to
one
answer
shot
anyway? Because I may not get. I think it's actually the best question you could possibly ask. I think it's the biggest question facing. It's one of two biggest questions facing the city of Atlanta housing policy. One is affordability going forward in wealthier neighborhoods, and the other is what do we do about vacancy in distressed neighborhoods. And I'm looking forward to that panel. I hope the city is going to be able to respond to it. I've been waiting for 4 years to get access to the housing vacancy study that they've been promising and haven't given me. I also think we need a very aggressive tax foreclosure program that other cities have used, and I'll be looking forward to the city's response, hopefully, on that.
And there is a lot of work underway in the city of Atlanta, and I know Invest Atlanta and others are working on that issue. So we definitely could have a whole morning talking about that issue. Thank you again, Dan and Mike, for being here this morning. And I'm going to hand it off to Susan Adams.